Our guest today is the congressman from Illinois' 5th Congressional District. He was elected a little over 10 years ago. Our guest today is the only Illinois member on the Appropriations Committee. He also serves on the influential House Committee on Intelligence. Our guest today did his undergraduate at Roosevelt University. There we go. I love it. Earned his master's degree in public policy at the University of Chicago. And let's hear this one. And graduated from Loyola University School of Law. There we go. All right, there we go. He and his wife, Barbara, live in Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood. He is the proud father of two fabulous daughters, Allison and Megan. Ladies and gentlemen, Congressman Mike Quigley. Congressman? All right, Michael. Thanks, Dad.
Thank you, my friends. It's great to be back. If only for the food. I see travel magazines that say 3 perfect days in some place. And I think I should do one, 3 perfect days in Chicago, just on the eating part, right? Because here we are in Maggiano's. I could point out, you know, Ann Sather's, Superdog, some of our D'Agostino's, Dinkle's Donuts, Bittersweet. I just keep going. So my travel magazine for Chicago would involve doing just what you're doing right now. Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to serve. It's an honor to be back. I want to recognize a few folks. Thanks to all the electeds and our friends at Loyola, my friends at Roosevelt, my few scattered University of Chicago folks who are here. Thanks for putting me in this position to accomplish this. I need to recognize, apparently, none of my offices are open because they're all here. My chief is in from D.C., Juan. He's from Northwest Indiana. Yay, Juan. Now, sitting at my table, because he helped me prepare today, my LD, Doug Lee. Victoria, Erica, Jenny, Jessica, you know what I'm talking about. Adam, they're all here, too. They're all awesome. Thank you so much. No matter what else I do, if I don't do service as well, I don't deserve to be here. On the unofficial side, thanks to Erica Kelly and the great folks at New Chicago, Tom Bowen and Christina Nowinski-Wurst. Yay! A couple thoughts before I began. I know there'll be questions. I had two questions before we started. One was, do we want to bring back congressional jail? Now, as tempting as that is, and I need to talk to our sheriff about that. As tempting as that is, it's probably not going to work, probably not going to happen. So I was thinking of worse punishments for congressional contempt, conceivably a 12-hour congressional committee markup. Somewhere in the 9th or 10th hour, they'd leave screaming from the room, "I give up, I give up." The second question I got, which I thought was interesting, is are you still having fun? Do you still enjoy it? Not in the, you know, President Obama era type fun that we all imagine, but look at what we're facing, folks, and where would I rather be? So I don't forget where I came from and in my roots. My roots came from, I see our mayoral friends and aldermanic friends working for Bernie Hansen and understanding that policy only matters when it works from the street up. So my county commissioner friends who are here, like Larry, that's where I'm rooted and that's where we remain. So important stuff. A thought at the top, and I was thinking about just reading from the Mueller report for, you know, 2 hours. But, you know, there's so many blank pages. I had to get the shot in, folks. That is an actual redacted page from the Mueller investigation. But I'll just read one small part. The Russians interfered in the 2016 presidential election in a sweeping and systematic fashion. Now, let's remember, the Trump campaign welcomed them. Nobody called the FBI. They all lied about it. And the president obstructed the investigation. So where do we go from here? What remains for us is the counterintelligence investigation to uncover truly what happened, hold those responsible, accountable, and prevent it from happening in the future. But whatever else you take from what I talked about last year, Mike Morrell, a former acting director, CIA under Obama and Bush, said what the Russians did was the political equivalent of 9/11. A pretty extreme statement, but true. But after doing this for over 2 years, I've come to the conclusion that we can overcome this. It will take some uniting of the country. It will take some inoculation against what the Russians did to prevent it from happening again. But we can overcome this. What scares me more than anything that's happened with the Russian investigation is the president's reaction to what the Russian did. It wasn't just the welcoming and the coordination which took place. It's the attack on the rule of law and the Constitution, right? And the fact that the attorney general became the president's press secretary and the attorney general acted as special counsel to the president. And all this time, my Republican colleagues in the House Intel Committee were working hand in glove with the president to obstruct the investigation. The attacks on the integrity of the entire intelligence community and the Justice Department, their independence, their ability to keep us safe. That's what we'll be struggling with for the rest of our lives. But it is not why we're here today. And I've been on Intel now. This is my third term. And I've discovered when I come back, it's usually in sounding the alarm warning. And I think I'm going to stop getting invited just because people want to sleep at night. Welcome to my world. No, today I want to take an opportunity to talk about something else. It is, in my mind, the defining national security challenge that will shape the rest of this century, economically, militarily, ideologically, technologically. And no, despite the dominating headlines, folks, it's not Russia. The greatest existential threat to this country, to our American national security, is the astonishing economic growth and the rising global influence of China. Now, we know the story of China's meteoric rise in our lifetime, particularly on the world stage. Once an isolated, impoverished country, it is now the second biggest economy in the world and growing at an extraordinary rate. When I was in high school, 90% of the Chinese population lived at the extreme poverty level. Today, 2%. And they have a GDP per capita that has grown 24 times. But as China has grown, so has its regional and global ambitions. The question we have to ask ourselves is how will China use this growing influence to reshape the rules, the institutions, or the entire international system? And I want to focus today just on a few of the specific national security challenges, because we could be here all day and I couldn't touch on all of them. But I'll touch on what I believe are the critical ones. First, 5G. I saw a billboard coming in, first to 5G, and they're talking about an American company, a dream, to say the least. China has a strategy to dominate the key technological sectors of the future through its Made in China 2025 initiative. Most pressing is China's ambition to control global communication networks through its next generation 5G telecom equipment. Belt and Road. We talk about an infrastructure project here in the United States, which we can't get going. China's doing it throughout the world. It seeks to extend its foreign influence and gain a strategic foothold in various regions through its massive Belt and Road infrastructure initiative. In addition, China is using this economic growth and wealth to become extremely powerful military. Every year for two decades, think about that, every year for two decades, China's military budget increased by double digits, reaching $175 billion in 2018. Now, we think, well, ours is much higher. But when we try to compare our military budget to Russia's or China's, we are not comparing apples to apples, largely because of how we fund and pay service members, for example. So when you see those numbers alongside each other, just remember it's not as dramatic. It is far more dramatic growth by China, and the comparisons aren't as different as we'd like to think. China aggressively, as well, uses its cyber capabilities to steal not just our intellectual property that belonged to our companies, but also U.S. military and intelligence secrets. The playbook is simple. Rob American companies and universities of its intellectual property, replicate that technology, replace American companies in the Chinese market, and eventually in the rest of the world. Our FBI director put it simply, no country poses a broader, more severe intelligence collection threat than China. Now, for my friends from schools here, some of this expanded espionage appears focused on colleges and universities, with more than 100 universities in the U.S. now in direct partnership with the Chinese government. And much of the research that they're going after involves the military. So let's focus on a few of these in a little more depth. 5G. We all know what 4G meant. Now, folks say, well, I don't even know what 2G, 3G, 4G. 3G gave you texting. 4G gave you streaming movies. But think about that throughout the economy and what 4G meant. Think about how much our economy has grown and how much of our economy depends on those companies that are selling 4G products. 5G will be able to support lightning-fast connectivity for billions of newly connected devices. 5G is going to deliver speeds 100 times faster than 4G. 5G will support the Internet of Things, self-driving cars, smart city developments, emergency services, healthcare systems, energy, aviation, pharmaceuticals, and others. By 2024, 40% of the world's population, 22 billion devices, from cars to refrigerators to cell phones to traffic lights, will be connected to the 5G network. But someone said, well, they're not, you know, chips aren't everywhere. We heard about companies doing security checks and finding out where chips are. They found out that their crock pot, I swear to God, their crock pot had a chip in it. Paranoia runs deep. This impressive innovation, because I want you to put these two together, the fact that 5G is extraordinary and that China will control it with the following. This impressive innovation does not come without risk. The arrival of 5G also means that the company or companies that control 5G will touch every aspect of your life. How many of you use the internet to protect your homes? How many of you use the internet to communicate through your cars? Right? Everything we're doing. But China, by far, is now best positioned to win the emerging global race to roll out 5G. Chinese telecom giants like Huawei and ZTE already own more than a third of the world's critical 5G patents, compared to 14% owned by U.S. firms like Qualcomm and Intel. Much of this is owed to the billions spent by Chinese firms on R&D. In 2017, Huawei spent $13 billion on R&D for 5G equipment. That was more than its chief rivals, Ericsson and Nokia, combined. Just four companies dominate the market for core network technologies that you're going to need for 5G. Two of them are Chinese, and none of them are American. Our inability to present an American alternative to Huawei and ZTE not only hurts us at home, but limits our ability to share alternative options with allies and partners. Look, at stake is whether the world will adopt the Chinese model that harnesses 5G as a tool that outside experts assess can be used for espionage, economic theft, coercion, and authoritarian rule. or the U.S. and Western model of using 5G as a platform for prosperity, human development, and privacy protection. We also know that China's aggressive global campaign of cyber espionage makes it almost certain that it will exploit the opportunities it gains as it strives to become the dominant player in the 5G supply chain. Recent hacks sponsored by China make clear that anything that passes through Chinese technology could become intelligence for China. Huawei denies that it would spy for China. Chinese law obligates that they do just the opposite. Huawei has also been heavily subsidized by the Chinese government, and company's leadership is known to have connections to both the Chinese military and its intelligence service. Now, how does this work? An easy way to envision this advantage is to imagine that the person who built your house decides to rob it. They know the layout, the power system, the access points. They may have kept a key and perhaps even built a way to gain secret entry. Building and maintaining core 5G network equipment provides a similar advantage. Major telecom backbone equipment is usually directly connected to the manufacturer over a dedicated channel, reporting back on equipment status and receiving updates and software patches as needed. You've seen this happen. But usually it happens without the operator's knowledge. Equipment could be sold and installed in a perfectly secure condition, and a month later the manufacturer could send a software update to gain access that allows it to track users, collect private data, or worse, launch a cyber-critical attack. U.S. telecommunication providers, particularly larger carriers such as AT&T and Verizon, they lack the U.S. equipment suppliers and rely on global supply chains that Chinese firms and manufacturers dominate. Although they do not source from Huawei and ZTE, our firms providers rely on other foreign 5G network systems that do rely on China. In February of 2018, the FBI director reiterated longstanding concerns about the United States' use of products from Huawei, stating, "We're deeply concerned about the risk of allowing any company or entity that is beholden to foreign governments that don't share our values to gain positions of power inside our telecommunication network." Now, the U.S. government's response so far has been to ban government agencies and contractors, including the military, from using Huawei and ZTE technology. Japan, Australia, New Zealand have all banned Huawei from building their 5G infrastructure. At least 11 European governments are currently considering similar boycotts. I was just in Estonia and Poland talking about these things. And what was fascinating is I was talking to our Polish allies about this very issue, and I walked outside, and there was another billboard where their soccer star was holding up a Huawei phone. How do you compete with that? The second threat I want to talk about is China's attempt to infiltrate and influence U.S. and global infrastructure through Belt and Way. And there may be extraordinarily legitimate economic considerations driving Belt and Road. The infrastructure projects proposed as part of this, are many of them would run through some of the Chinese poorest and least developed regions. Their aim to provide stimulus to help cushion the effects of economic slowdowns. Moreover, the construction is intended to make use of China's enormous industrial overcapacity and ease the entry of Chinese goods into regional markets. However, China's bolder strategy of creating a foundation to assert geopolitical influence can't be overlooked. China needs friends, and Beijing is heavily focused on its neighbors. Lending them money for extensive infrastructure projects is part of that. But Pakistan is running out of money to repay the loans, part of the broader pattern of what critics have deemed China's debt trap diplomacy. China has been enthusiastic about conducting business in politically volatile countries, lending heavily to Venezuela, Cambodia, Zimbabwe. But these countries are being saddled with large amounts of debt, sometimes resulting in the country's governments defaulting, leaving them vulnerable to China's influence and ceding possession of the developed projects to China. And the U.S. is not immune from this. One of the largest capital expenditures that transit agencies tend to need to make is rolling stock. the physical cars you've all been on a daily basis that we ride each day. Only a few companies compete in this space. It is noteworthy then when a Chinese company starts making inroads in the market by significantly undercutting the existing players and offering stock to transit agencies around the U.S. for a fraction of the competitor's price. Thanks to Made in China 2025, government subsidies, and a de-emphasis on profit. It's understandable how these agencies react. They're cost competitive. It's tough to, we're way behind on our capital improvements for all this rolling stock as well. But there are a number of serious potential consequences associated with the Chinese dominance and Chinese in this infrastructure. These include security concerns. So I often run into a problem being on the committee. I can't talk about what I've been briefed on, so I refer to people's actions and other people's quotes. These security concerns are so serious that in Washington, D.C., the Pentagon has expressed the fact that to the local transit agency that it doesn't want Chinese made rail cars servicing the Pentagon Metro rail stations. As of last week, there is now a bicameral bipartisan effort in Congress to prevent public money from being used to procure transit infrastructure from these Chinese companies. A number of senators, including Senate Intelligence Committee Vice Chairman Mark Warner, have expressed deep reservations about a Washington, D.C. rolling stock procurement decision, going so far as to send a letter to the agency instructing them more fully consider the security implications of a contract with Chinese manufacturers. Perhaps as insidious as all this is the fact that by driving all these other companies potentially out of the market because of subsidies and the de-emphasis on profit, they become the only game in town. And we are dependent on what can be a very hostile nation for the ability to replace our rail cars. As a military threat, we have to look back. After World War II, the United States remained the dominant military presence in Asia to promote trade, security, and cooperation to prevent the emergence of a central regional power, again, like Japan. But as China rises, it's challenging us, the U.S. presence and influence in the region, in an extraordinarily aggressive fashion. The president significantly accelerated China's military modernization in late 2017, requiring the Army to become fully modern by 2035 and world-class by the mid-century. By that year, China will likely to be able to contest U.S. operations throughout the entire Indo-Pacific region. Ultimately, China aspires to return to its dominant position it enjoyed in Asia for thousands of years before a century of colonial rule. It's doing so by translating this wealth into military power. I mentioned before that China's military budget has increased by double digits every year, reaching $175 billion in 2018. Our budget's around $700 billion, but the cost differential on wages is enough to concern us and allow us much closer. Of greater concern is ability to invest strategically in new technologies aimed at countering U.S. advantages while asserting its regional foreign policy aim. Their military continues to develop in advanced weapons and hardware while honing its ability to fight in all military domains. Some of the most important new domains include competition with the U.S. on artificial intelligence, quantum computing, both of which are serious, serious threats to America's competitive edge. AI can improve autonomous systems, wargaming, simulation, and information processing. Quantum computing threatens to break widely used encryption standards that safeguard information in the public and private sector. Begin to appreciate what those codes mean to our military. If the U.S. falls behind in the development of AI and quantum computing, China could hone battlefield advantages that will limit our ability to win a war, defend our allies, and preserve regional order. So, what do we do? We really should do at least three things. Develop a moonshot strategy to compete with technologies, harden our defenses to counter these cyber threats, and deal with strategies that combat China's unfair trade practices without, from today's headlines, a devastating trade war. it is likely that China will lead in development of the equipment needed to build out 5G networks. But the U.S. must be ready to lead in developing the technologies whose success is dependent on 4G. 4G, which made its commercial debut in 2011, made smartphones, mobile apps more appealing, more possible, apps to reach critical mass before competitors from other countries giving us an edge. This will require, as I said, a moonshot public investment in national R&D. One of the reasons I'm here is to point out we're doing just the opposite. In 21 of the 27 years following 1990, federal research and development spending has made up a smaller share of GDP than the year before. At around $120 billion, federal R&D slid to just 0.62% of GDP in 2017, the lowest level since 1955, ironically, 2 years before Sputnik. To match the levels of the 1980s, funding would need to be about 80% higher. Now, let's just put this in our perspective of what we know and work with and what we've lived with in our lives. Thanks to government funding of research, nuclear industry, the space program, the aviation industry, the internet, just some of those elements, and so much of our economy drives on these matters. But a moonshot investment doesn't just mean considerably more funding for innovation. We need better policies to spur tech commercialization, especially for national labs and universities, a redesign of our workforce development system to ensure American workers have the skills they need, and ultimately, we must continue to lead the way in providing the world with alternatives that give both domestic and international markets access to high-quality, secure tech products. As it relates to cyber threats, the administration has demanded that Beijing halt state-sponsored cyber attacks. It's also ramped up the law enforcement response. These are useful and important first steps. But since there's little chance that indicted hackers are going to show up at our courthouse anytime soon, we should move past just indictments to targeted sanctions on companies, universities, researchers, and individuals caught using and stealing U.S. intellectual property, something we haven't done nearly as much as we have with Russia. The federal government should help small companies increase their cyber defenses against Chinese hackers and strengthen counterintelligence to identify the sectors and companies under threat. And I begin with our universities. Counterintelligence officials should be brief firms in these sectors on cybersecurity best practices. And since most of the employees are small tech companies, are unlikely to have security clearances, they need to declassify some information that will help them do that. We also have new ways to help other countries spend in secure infrastructure equipment, perhaps with subsidies, so perhaps with banning other equipment to move forward. And as it relates to unfair trade practices, let me put that in a larger context here. A trade war hurts everybody. It will hurt people here in Chicago. Go talk to Mary Howe from how manufacturing on Elston Avenue, what additional tariffs mean to her. Talk to the American farmer. 42% of Illinois crops are exported. It's going to hurt us. The best and brightest in briefing us have warned of a recession, inevitable recession, or at least a downturn because a boom can't continue forever. But they're warning that this will expedite that, and it could and probably will if this continues much sooner. So, how do we address unfair trade practices and all the problems with China? Here's how you don't do it. You don't do it by yourself. It gets to the issue, one of the issues I talked about last year. We are stronger together as a country. What we've lost touch of because, you know, America first notions is this isolationist policy works that is working on a military basis and an economic basis. The two work hand in hand. The two are intertwined. We are less safe by isolating ourselves. We missed the chance at a Pacific Rim trade deal. When I was in Cambodia, in Thailand, in Vietnam, in South Korea, they were begging us to do a trade deal because they wanted someone to compete with China because they knew what we know now. China's growth will spur their military growth, which threatens their independence. They don't want an isolated dominant force being their only choice. So when we isolate ourselves economically, we isolate ourselves militarily, when we pull out of trade deals, when we go to war on trade deals with our allies, when Canada is mad at us about trade, how many people here think that our NATO allies trust us on anything now? That we would be there in an Article 5 issue. Last year I quoted FDR in his last inaugural. You think about everything this country went through and what Churchill and FDR did to rally people past the isolationist policies that if had they succeeded, the Nazis would have certainly won. So in his shortest inaugural, near death, he said something we all need to remember today when we counter any of these threats. He quoted Emerson by saying, in the final analysis, it's as simple as appreciating that to have a friend, you need to be one. Who are we a friend to today? That has to change. Because if we're going to counter these threats, we have to do it together. We have to find room to work with these countries, to work on all the pressing issues that matter to all of us. Thank you so much for having me. God bless. Time to stump the congressman.
Can you get some water? Can you hand me his water? Jay? His water. Okay. So when I left the movie AI, I just went home and read a book. I was like, I can't do all this intelligence. It was just too much. Today, I think I'm going to go back to my office and just read a book. I don't know. Thank you, Congressman, for all of this. We've got some questions. Lots of them. Anybody else have questions? Get them up here now. If not, we're going to go with these. All right, we're going. This is actually, I don't know who asked this question, but I'm just going to say it. He's already answered it mostly. How much of China's advancement is being funded by interest paid by the U.S. on money borrowed?
Oh, well, sure. The bulk of our debt's because we fought wars. When we entered a war in World War II and raised taxes. We entered the Iraq War and cut taxes and borrowed money from China to fund it. So we are in debt, and we have funded China's capacity to outdo us in the new competitive Cold War.
Bird Hoffman? You wait here. You left because you must have...
No, he's right there.
Okay. So I'm assuming that you're going to know what this question says. It says, how do we get past the dreaded T word to pay for all the technology investment we need?
T?
Yeah, I think it's...
Taxes.
Oh, taxes. I thought it was Trump.
Oh.
Oh, you don't know that?
When I was a county commissioner and Larry Suffren and I were building alliances to beat back unnecessary taxes and move the county forward on an appropriate basis, the message was clear. You're not going to solve all your problems with new revenues. The problem that we've entered into is the tax plan that was passed in Congress will open about a $1.5 trillion additional hole. And I see the former head of the Federal Reserve here in Chicago shaking his head, yes, a $1.5 trillion hole in the debt and the deficit. And Goldman Sachs and the Tax Institute said that that part of the tax bill will grow the economy less than 1% in the next 10 years. So that's a bad way to do this. In the end, for Chicago, for the state, for our country, it has to be a combination of a more efficient government system, additional revenues. It has to be that combination. You're not going to solve all our problems by raising revenues only, but if what you do is a tax plan, as my Republican colleagues did, that blows a massive hole in this, you're losing your ability to do something like this. And what if there was a mistake in the beginnings of this previous administration, or the Obama administration, we ran out of time. But the focus had we had a second term, would have been a massive infrastructure program to grow the economy for all time. You know, this country used to, on infrastructure, dream big and build bigger. And even the, you know, the core aspects of what FDR did in the New Deal, we're still enjoying the benefits of those. They're still important to our economy, something we need to keep in mind.
Thank you, sir. Jack Hartman, are you here? Oh, here he is. Have you thought about increasing cyber funding with a capital bill?
We're thinking of in a cyber bill, in an infrastructure bill, we're thinking about cyber being a big component of that. And obviously, it has to come with additional protections. But, you know, having the internet capabilities throughout the entire country is extremely important. So infrastructure can't just be roads and bridges, although for those of you who take Metra, the fact that the switching out there was put in during the Hoover administration might give you pause. And the bridge that they go over is one of the worst in Illinois, and we've had a bridge right here, right over Lakeshore Drive, which obviously needs repairs. So, but we can't just think about it that way, right? We got to rebuild the blue line. And I know the current mayor wants to build a Star Trekian path to O'Hare. Great if they can do it, but you know, I want to rebuild the blue line in a technology that might work in my lifetime.
Star Trekian, I like that. Warren Merrick, are you here? Warren, we got to work on your membership, dude. It's $50.
So I'm not going to answer it until you pay.
I knew we liked him for some reason, Jay. So what national security questions should the regular U.S. citizen be looking out for with respect to the U.S.-China relations for the rest of this presidential term?
Well, I think I touched on them. But I'm sitting here in Chicago. The only thing I would add to answer your question about security issues is this country has amnesia about 9/11, right? We need to dramatically increase homeland security grants and protect and harden our infrastructure, right? We need COP grants for additional providers, first responders, but we need to protect our critical infrastructure, and we're not there yet. Those grants, actually, some of them got zeroed out. Many of them are reduced, but we need to remember the threats that exist. And when I am told, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, by people in this city, well, there's no real threat out there right now. When is the last time a terrorist attack was seen before? There was maybe a 15-minute warning in the attack that you heard about overseas. But the rest of it, this isn't going to heaven forbid, but it wouldn't happen like 9/11. I don't envision that. With everything I've been briefed, this will be inspired, not instructed. It is cheaper and cheaper, unfortunately, to make an attack. They are becoming less sophisticated. People driving a car through a crowd, a car bomb, opening up with a weapon in a crowded street. So if question is, what should Americans be concerned about beyond what I talked about today? It's just that. The threats are still there. ISIS is a damaged, angry animal, and they're most likely to try to create as much damage as they possibly can in the homeland. Back to the losing sleep thing.
Or me just reading a book with pages that turn. I don't have to worry about there being a chip. Picture pages. Yeah, that even works. So here are two questions with respect to insurance from Rose Otten from the Friendship Center and Laura Garcia Design. I'm going to ask them both, and you can figure out how to mesh them together.
And do they pay their dues?
I don't know. Are they here? Okay. You paid your dues? I like Congressman Quigley. You serve one of the most progressive districts in Illinois. At a time when many Democrats are signing on to H.R. 676, supporting for universal single-payer health care, will you join the movement to provide comprehensive coverage for all citizens? First part of the question.
Okay.
Second, would you please discuss your thoughts on health insurance overall, how can we increase planned options and lower costs for those who buy insurance through the Illinois Exchange as opposed to accessing insurance via their employers?
Sure. Well, a couple things. I'm an appropriator. There's one other in Illinois we didn't mention. We had to change my intro. It's Sherry Bustos is now an appropriator. So the appropriation process is one element of how we can change these things to provide proper funding to existing programs and to stop my Republican colleagues from doing things like defunding Planned Parenthood. So winning back the House helps stop them from trying to eliminate the health care law and to stop defunding Planned Parenthood. So that was the first critical element. The second one is when I sat down 10 years ago and I got sworn in into the House, a special election. So, you know, you speak, Nancy stops everything, you speak for 4 or 5 minutes, and I sat down. The first person to come up to me was Congressman Mark Kirk, and he said something that was interesting. He said, you're going to get a lot of advice, but the best advice I can give you is anything that happens here happens in the middle. So it's interesting. My first term, there were 54 center-right Republicans, about 50 center-left Democrats. There's probably 100 now. And people really didn't like a lot of the blue dogs. They didn't like some of the centrist Democrats because they weren't for single payer, right? But because those districts were won, we had control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, unlike now, and we passed the health care law, right? And back then, my office was picketed by the far right and folks on the left who were mad that I wasn't for single payer, and they were mad that I was for the health care law. Somehow something got done. And as a result of that, women now don't pay more just because they're women for health care. And pre-existing conditions weren't a death sentence. And there are no longer lifetime caps. And my daughters could stay on my health care benefits till they were 23. And millions more Americans got preventative care and health care as a whole. So what Obama said at the time was right. This is an evolutionary fight. And I'm for dramatically moving us along those lines, recognizing that right now, in 2019, my best shot is to prevent this president from doing something even worse and to winning back the Senate and winning back the White House and moving forward on all those things. But we won back the House in the middle. I know who you're hearing from on social media, but there are a lot of talented centrist Democrats who got elected that way because they didn't win in far-left districts. They won in centrist districts. They won the House back because they were winning back Republican districts. So some of us have to be practical to get dramatic things done. That seems inconsistent today. And part of the problem, and it could be a question about climate change, it could be a question about gun violence, is that practical solution got us where we are. We passed climate change. We just passed a bill just this last week on pre-existing conditions. We passed a gun violence bill for the first time since I've been there. Dramatically great things happen. It seems inconsistent. Well, you won through the center, but you're doing all these amazing things. I'll tell you right now, single payer doesn't have a chance to pass in the House alone. Clearly not in the center sign. So, but I think there's ways of continually, dramatically moving us forward. So I'm on Higgins' bill, 50 and above Medicare for all. Jan Schakowsky's bill, which provides that single-payer option for the states to do, which we're now seeing the first state to do just that sort of thing. We can move farther down the field in a dramatic fashion. The goal is and must always be to ensure every single American. We have to do it in a way that you can afford. And frankly, some of the proposals that were out there in my last term would have meant that you have to give up your private insurance coverage. I'm not sure most Americans were comfortable with that yet. We move America only as far as we can and maybe a little farther. So that is a practical solution to provide dramatic change, right? We're doing it this way, we won back the House. Doing it this way, we're going to win back the Senate, and we're going to win back the White House, and we're going to move us down the field even further.
So, Charlotte Newfield, are you here? No?
I know Charlotte really well.
Oh, then I have to ask her a question because if they're not here, I usually blow the question off. Thanks, Charlotte. You put me in a position here. She's from the Jarvis Bird Sanctuary, and we were talking about environmental stuff. What is your plan and direction to save our environment, specifically Lake Michigan?
That should only take a minute. Charlotte and I were, she was the president, I was vice president of No Lights in Wrigley Field. And yes, I am aware that there are lights in Wrigley Field, thank you. Look, if I wanted to win all the battles, I wouldn't be a Cub fan, a Democrat. But Charlotte now does great work by the bird, by the totem pole near Addison, the bird sanctuary there. It's great stuff. So she's one of those people that, while maybe not everybody knows them, she spent a lifetime of advocacy. Like healthcare, winning back the House meant we could stop this draconian, horrible plan of dismantling environmental regulation. They're still doing it unilaterally. Go online and watch my Chicago-esque exchange with the Interior Secretary just a week ago. So much of this is public messaging and the practical solution of winning back the Senate. We're stopping them from doing the worst of the horrible things. I got into this business because I'm an environmentalist. I began here in Region 5 U.S. EPA air programs and quit in protest because of the Reagan administration's environmental policies. I now talk to EPA employees all the time and say, please don't do what I did. Stay here. This is a long, arduous fight. But it's the fight that really matters. I do climate tours every year. I was just in National Lakeshore, a national park now, thank you very much. We were in the Everglades, and my staff and I were in the Rocky Mountain National Park looking at the effects of climate change on the environment. You look at mountains there, and a third of the trees are gray skeletons because of climate change and the beetle. In the Everglades, you see the land drying up, and you see in the right over here in Indiana, they're predicting they're going to lose about 40% of their bird species. We have to have victories at the individual corporate level. We have to have victories at the state and local level. Right now, it is messaging and stopping this administration from doing as much as we can to devastating this environment. As Obama said, you're the first generation to feel the effects of climate change and the last one that can do anything about it. Probably time for one more, right? Okay.
Well, that's one more. I guess that means one more question, huh?
Right.
So I'm going to go with this one, I think. Bennett Lawson, are you here?
That
Do you know
is
these
so
people?
Familiar. I know that one.
Are you a member, Bennett?
I am.
Okay. If you had one more minute with Ben Carson, what would you have asked?
Yeah. Ben and I had a colorful conversation in which I was quoting Billy Madison at the end. You may want to go back and see that. I met with the housing secretary with the LGBTQ advocates right here in Chicago, and he listened and didn't do anything about it. And the issue involved how we treat particularly trans youth at shelters and discrimination policies. And he was basically saying, well, I would have posted this but you wouldn't have liked what happened, which to me meant he would have gone along with this discrimination. So we went back and forth, and I think I made that clear. And I understand he's very devout, and I completely respect that. So I think what I probably would have questioned is I probably would have brought up his knowledge of the Bible and asked him if there's anything in the Bible about no room at the inn and what a good person who believes in these things would respond, but I ran out of time. And then there's a part of me that's glad that I ran out of time because, again, the snarky Chicago S would have elevated even more. And yeah, you probably all would have seen that because, the mayor's not the only one in town with a colorful vocabulary. Go ahead.
You want me to ask the other two? Okay.
Yeah,
I got that translation. It was one more question, but now he's saying we can go. So let's see. Are the policies that are advancing voting and stop outside of Interforce. I'm sorry. What policies are you advancing to, one, increase access to voting and stop outside interference of electoral process? And what should we be looking forward to in 2020?
First of all, I'm the sponsor of legislation that provided $380 million for election grants, right? The Russians attacked our democratic process. Illinois is the first state they hacked into. Illinois, I think, got about $12 million of that to buy new equipment, training, anti-hacking software. Fact is, something like 40 states, their equipment is so old they can't even use anti-hacking software. Pretty vulnerable, right? DNI Coates, not a real liberal guy, said the red lights are still flashing, the warnings there, because Comey said the Russians will be back. They never left. So there's the outside threat in that regard. And I promise you, as the chairman of the Financial Services General Government Subcommittee, our priority is to make sure we have far more funding to prevent that. There's also voter suppression issues. There will be a number of bills in Washington that deal with existing legislation and proposed legislation that deal with voter suppression for internal reasons, very sinister. Election reforms as a whole, you know, we have to deal with the fact that so much money is dark money and the transparency and accountability is lacking. What to expect in 2020? If you really, really don't like watching sausages or politics getting made, don't watch this. This will be ugly. This will strain all of your tolerance for such things. But the stakes are as high as they've ever been. Who are we as a country? The Reagan Republican Party is no more. That's dangerous in the sense that I thought of Reagan as a reactionary, right? He's moderate compared to folks that we're dealing with now, right? So who's in the centrist middle at all? So that's of concern. As far as people predicting who will win, you know, this far out, who nationally knew who Barack Obama was, who Jimmy Carter was, right, Bill Clinton? So let's see who comes out of Iowa. Keep focused on all of these things. Let's see if the president has any competition. The last time I saw President Obama at the White House, he said, it was a holiday party just before he left. And he said, I said, we miss you already. And he said, it's going to be okay. And I said, no, it's not. But we were both right. It is not okay. But I think it will be. But not if we just give up, stop paying attention, get aggravated with that situation, and do more. Everything you cared about is at stake. It is that dramatic. I will tell you that, as I said at the beginning, this isn't fun, but, you know, when I was asked at a high school, are you still having fun? I said, you know, I don't know. I said, I can't compare myself to her, but I'm not sure Mother Teresa said, oh, that was a fun day. But what she was doing was really important. And I don't say, boy, that was a fun day, fighting the housing secretary, the interior secretary, the president, trying to communicate this to the world on CNN and MSNBC in a manner that would, I'd like to think, change their way of viewing this and win that middle, because it is important to get all these things done. So I just want you to know, I know I wouldn't be here without my help and support from all of you at home, and it means the world to me. And when those things are happening, I think of you. I can't listen to every single thought and say, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do, but collectively I am Chicago, for better or worse. Thank you for that, and God bless. Oh.